Let me tell you what my deep research and basically vision is.
I hope there's Bigfoot. I don't think there is.
I'm not telling you nothing.
The aliens won't let it happen.
Happening now, breaking.
Bernie Sanders is a
Bears beats Battlestar Galactica.
What are the tips? Give me some tips on how to work with Wes Anderson.
Be ready to speak very fast and very clearly, because that's definitely one key thing.
I will only tell the truth. I will only
until you and six kids you barely know in wet bathing suits have surrounded nine chimpanzees outside of a Wendy's. You probably really don't know yourself, okay?
Yep. And we back.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to your new favorite podcast and the best in political, sports, and paranormal news coverage. I'm your host, Wes Anderson, and this is In the Shed. This is episode 13, so whether you're back for more or finding us for the first time this week, hey, thanks for tuning in. It's late Friday evening, May 7th, and I am in a shed in the backyard of my home in Alabama, just so I can hang out with you tools and talk about the latest headlines, stories, and rumors in the world of politics, sports, and the paranormal. We made it to our 13th episode, my tools, episode number 13 here on Friday, May the 7th, 2021. We're going to go with lucky number 13, not unlucky. We don't do unlucky here on In the Shed with Wes. We make our own luck, my babies. We make our own luck. And we're going to say that tonight is lucky number 13, our 13th episode, and also May the 7th, 2021 happens to also be the first birthday of my son Malachi. Yeah, it's little man's birthday today. He's been celebrating hard all day with a double ear infection, hand, foot, and mouth, and a 102-degree fever. My playful, happy, smiley boy has not wanted to play, has not been happy, and has just wanted to be held all day long today. I felt bad for the little dude celebrating his first birthday this way. But he'll be back up and running in a couple days. He is a huge blessing to our family. Malachi, we love you so much. He's going to hear his voice, hear his daddy saying his name. He's going to think that's pretty cool, even at 1 year old, because he is a smart fella. We got a big show for you tonight. In addition to this being our 13th episode and also my son's birthday, another important thing is coming up on Sunday, and that's Mother's Day. Did you remember Mother's Day? You can't forget Mother's Day now. Go online, use the Google machine to find a flower shop, and send some flowers to your mama. Your mama done put up with you your whole life. Send some flowers to your mama. Send some to your grandmama while you're at it, maybe your favorite auntie. But hey, fellas, if you're married, and if you're not, that's okay. We got love for you here on In the Shed. But if you're married, if, don't forget about your wives. Don't forget about your wives, because look, I've heard husbands say before, Mother's Day is for mothers, and my wife is not my mother. And that is not a winning strategy. I've been in the game almost 10 years. Let me tell you, fellas, that is not a winning strategy. If your wife is mother to your kid, you better get her something for Mother's Day. If your wife puts up with you every day, you better get her something for Mother's Day. And you better not get her a toaster oven or a vacuum cleaner, not unless she specifically asked for it. No, no. You better send that lady to the spa or to get her nails done. You better buy her some pretty flowers, take her out to a fancy dinner, or send her on a trip with her girls. Because if she putting up with you, and if she carried your child, the least you can do is honor her in a way that is special this one day a year. I'm not saying you don't do it any other day, but I'm saying you better do it on this day. And that day is Sunday. So remember your mama, remember your grandmama. But fellas, if you are married, and if you and your wife have children, please do not forget your wife on Mother's Day this Sunday. I beg you. A great show for you tonight. A lot of news to cover. But before that, let's go to some comments and corrections from last week's episode. Keystone 107. That's right, we hit triple digits. Panobia 86, Townsend 8, South Dakota, Oklahoma, Tennessee. Who will come out on top? You can reach us by emailing the show at intheshedwithwes@gmail.com. As we said on last week's show, we are now publicly feuding with my cousin's podcast, 8 Bits and Bobbles. It's a great show. I'm about 8 minutes into their latest episode, and the controversy has yet to be addressed. But if they want to get froggy, we can certainly leave shawty. Also, you'll be glad to know that my meemaw sent me a text message this week to let me know that she is all caught up on the show. She had never listened to 8 Bits and Bobbles, but she is planning to do so after my recommendation. We're the only show on the air that be recommending our competition. But we're going to keep pressing on. Last week, I guessed that Kris Jenner is very good at strategic games. That was, in fact, a guess. In actuality, I have no idea whether or not that is a true statement at all. Last week, we also talked about Caitlyn Jenner's bid to run for governor of California. She made several media appearances this week and is off to a less than stellar start. We are continuing to build our listenership, which is all thanks to you. All aboard the listenership, everybody is invited. Keep spreading the word, sharing the show. Run on over and give us a follow on Twitter, and let's grow this thing together. All right, that's all the comments and corrections for this week. Let's get to some listener emails. Ron from Wisconsin says, Wes, I listen to your cousin's podcast. You're right. It is better than yours. Ron, listen, man. I didn't say that 8 Bits and Bobbles was better than ours. I said the production was better. You said that it was better than ours. I said that the production value is better. I said that they do a really good job with what they do, that I'm just in the shed with an extension cord. I didn't say that the programming or the show itself was better. In fact, that is what you have said, and I don't know how to feel about it. But thanks for telling me I'm not as good as my cousin, I guess. Vanessa from Alabama says, I have experienced time slips before while driving. Very freaky stuff. Vanessa, that is very freaky, especially for anyone else on the road with you. And you're in my home state. That's a little bit terrifying for me. You're experiencing time slips while driving a car. I don't know how I feel about that. Tyndall from Louisiana writes, Wes, give it up. You're not going to get invited to any of those Bigfoot festivals. Tyndall, so far I have to agree with you. We've been asking Keystone to invite us officially for 107 days, Hanobia for 86 days, and Townsend for 8 days. It's not looking good, but we're going to keep pressing on. We don't give up on In the Shovel West. That is one thing we don't do. We're going to keep asking. We're going to keep inviting ourselves. Maybe one of those places will come through. And finally, Jerry from Texas says, the earth is indeed flat. How do I know? You can tell at the beach. Also, since we've never actually been to space, you can throw out all of the proof, that's in quotes, of a spherical Earth provided by NASA. The truth is out there if you want to find it. Okay. Well, I did ask if anybody that heard the podcast believed that the Earth is flat for you to email the show. I did not think that somebody would actually do that, but my boy Jerry from Texas says that, in fact, the Earth is flat, and he knows because when he's at the beach, he can tell. So there's that. Thank you for listening to the show, Jerry. You sound like a fun guy. That's all the listener emails from this week. If you have thoughts that you want to share about one of the stories talked about on our show, or if you just want to say hi, you can reach us by emailing the show at intheshedwithwes@gmail.com. Again, that's intheshedwithwes@gmail.com. All right, let's switch to this. Let's get to some news in the world of politics, and let's hit the headlines. Biden says our economy moving in right direction after grim jobs report, writes Breitbart. Ex-White House press secretary likely to be LGBT, according to Newsmax. California sees population fall for the first time ever, says the BBC. From Bloomberg, rent surges on single-family homes with landlords testing market. And finally, the House GOP chooses Trump's big lie over Liz Cheney, and that's according to The New Yorker. Our first news story this week, a Russian model trapped on a Chinese reality TV show was finally voted off after months of self-sabotage. He says he's happy to go home. A Russian model who was effectively trapped in a Chinese reality show has finally been eliminated after months of self-sabotage. Vladislav Ivanov, who has an awesome name, 27, from the East Russian city of Vladivostok, became an accidental star in China after he was drafted to compete in Produce Camp 2021, a boot camp-style Chinese TV show in which people compete to form a boy band. After 3 months of putting on one half-hearted performance after another, Ivanov, better known by his stage name Lelush, was finally allowed to leave the show after being voted off in the competition's final round. According to the Washington Post, Ivanov never formally auditioned for nor intended to compete in the Producer Camp 2021 show. He was initially employed as an on-set translator to help two Japanese contestants, but producers noticed him and asked him to sign on after the staff mistook him for a competitor. The director saw that I'm fluent in Mandarin, and they thought I'm good-looking, so they asked if I'd like to try and experience a new lifestyle, he said in an interview. Dancing and singing every day, I'm really exhausted and now starting to regret my decision, he added. In early clips from the show, Ivanov said, I hope the judges won't support me. While the others want to get an A, I want to get an F, as it stands for freedom. I want to go home. Yo, they got this man trapped. They got this man trapped on this Chinese reality TV show. This man said, I hope the judges don't support me. Everyone else wants to get an A. I want to get an F because F stands for freedom. He said, I want to go home in the interview. This man literally could not go home until he got voted. Like, he couldn't just be like, I quit. I don't like this. It's not enjoyable to me. But that was not to be. Chinese fans seemed intrigued by how little he cared about the show, and they kept voting for him to stay. According to the rules of the show, I won today. But to me, I've lost again, he said during the show's second round of rankings. I don't want to be in the group. My dreams are to make designs, enjoy my freedom, and be a model. To his dismay, members of his newfound fandom were mesmerized by his lackluster and off-key performance of a Russian rap song, Jackpot. As a part of the show, Ivanov was monitored on the show's 24/7 TV feeds. This is some Truman Show type stuff right here, like for real. Clips circulated on China's Weibo social network of Ivanov staring out of the window looking longingly towards freedom. This is getting sad. It went from funny to sad. Or grinning whenever he came close to getting kicked off the show. According to The Guardian, his fans even encouraged one another to vote for him and let him get 996, a Chinese term for referring to chronic overwork in which people work from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week. Some even rented billboards on the front of shopping centers encouraging people to support him. Ivanov's wish came true after 3 months of competing. He was eliminated on Saturday after again asking fans to help him escape having to debut in a Chinese boy band. Once the program ends, I will smile more. Now that I'm here, I have no mood to smile, he said in a live stream before the show's finals. Thank y'all for your support. I am finally clocking out, he told his 1.5 million Weibo followers on Saturday. Yo, they had this man trapped on a Chinese television show like Jim Carrey in The Truman Show. This man wanted to lose every competition. Why didn't he just quit? That's a crazy story. That's a crazy story. That man was trapped on a TV show and wanted to go home. And this is why you come to In the Shed with Wes, because you won't find news like this anywhere else. You're not going to find this on CNN, on Fox News. You come to us for the real. You come to us for the news. We're the only place in the world talking about some Chinese television show and a man that didn't want to be there. I'm in a shed at midnight in Alabama talking about a guy who got stuck on a Chinese reality TV show and didn't want to be in the boy band. That's what I'm doing with my life. And if you're listening to this podcast, that's what you're doing with your life too. He said F stands for freedom. That would make a killer t-shirt, man. You could sell a bunch of them joints online. Our next story: India crosses 20 million COVID-19 cases as critical shortages worsen. India has now reported more than 20 million coronavirus infections, including nearly 3.5 million people who are actively being treated for COVID-19. The country's health system is in a state of collapse, as hospitals and clinics face dire shortages of beds and life-saving supplies. In just the past week, India has seen its COVID-19 cases jump by 2,646,526, a figure that, if it stood alone, would currently make India the 14th worst-hit nation in the world, according to data compiled by Johns Hopkins University. On April 27th, the government reported 17 million total cases. By Tuesday, the number had risen to 20 million. As alarming as the recent figures are, experts say that they are almost certainly an undercount, possibly by a lot. At this pace of infection, India is probably only detecting 3-4% of its cases, says Chris Murray, director of the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington. So we're talking about every day maybe 5 million infections a day in India right now. That's a huge number. Oxygen shortages are blamed for deaths at even the best-equipped urban hospitals. On Saturday in the capital, New Delhi, 12 patients died at Batra Hospital after the facility ran out of medical oxygen. A tanker delivery had arrived just 90 minutes late. Meanwhile, at Bala District Hospital, a facility in the rural area of Uttar Pradesh in northern India, a local reporter saw more than 20 patients on the floor struggling to breathe. Helpless cries of pain filled the air. Not a single doctor was in attendance, she reported. On Saturday, India expanded COVID-19 vaccine eligibility, theoretically allowing everyone over 18 to register to get the potentially life-saving shots. But the country has nowhere near enough vaccine doses for its adult population, and the vaccination effort has slowed across India as a whole. Clinics in several states have closed completely due to lack of supply. As of Tuesday, nearly 159 million vaccine doses had been administered in a country whose population is nearly 1.4 billion. Seven Indian states have each reported more than 1 million COVID-19 cases, and others are soaring toward that mark. The most confirmed cases are in Maharashtra, which has reported nearly 4.8 million cases, roughly equal to the total of Russia. At least 222,408 people have died from COVID-19 in India, according to the country's health ministry. Only Brazil and the U.S. have higher death tolls. The U.S. continues to have the most confirmed COVID-19 cases in the world with nearly 32.5 million. More than 577,000 Americans have died from the disease. So I know that's a bit of a hard transition to go from a guy who does not want to be in a boy band on a Chinese reality TV show to the pandemic and its crushing effect on India. But that's the kind of show that we are. We keep it lighthearted. We cover the important stuff as well. And if you've listened to the show, you know that the nation of India is a place that we have a soft spot for. It is our second biggest audience as a nation. India makes up 20% of our listenership here on In the Shed with Wes. We have a good friend there named Ramesh who has emailed the show several times, who has gotten family members to listen to the show. We just want to say that we hope that everything goes as well as it can over there, that we are thinking about you, India. Ramesh, we are thinking about you. If you are a praying person, we invite you to pray for the people of India, to pray for the doctors there, to pray that they would have the supplies that they need. If you have the ability to help, if you can find a way to donate, we encourage you to do that too. And if you're not a praying person, send your good energy, your good vibes, whatever it is that you do, focus it toward the people of India because they are up against it right now. And we're going to keep an eye on that here on In the Shed. That is a nation that has a special place in our heart that has supported us from the beginning of this show. And if there's any way that we can help, if you're listening to this and you know of something that can be done where we can come alongside you and help out, please email us at intheshedwithwes@gmail.com and we will be all about that. Our next story, U.S. backs waiving intellectual property rules on vaccines. The Biden administration on Wednesday joined calls for more sharing of technology behind the COVID-19 vaccines to help speed the end of the pandemic, a shift that puts the U.S. alongside many in the developing world who want rich countries to do more to get doses to the needy. U.S. Trade Representative Katherine Tai announced the government's position amid World Trade Organization talks about a possible temporary waiver of its protections that would allow more manufacturers to produce the life-saving vaccines. The administration believes strongly in intellectual property protections, but in service of ending this pandemic, supports the waiver of those protections for COVID-19 vaccine purposes, Tai said in a statement. She cautioned that it would take time to reach the required global consensus to waive the protections under WTO rules, and U.S. officials said it would not have an immediate effect on the global supply of COVID-19 shots. In a tweet, the director of the Africa Center of Disease Control and Prevention, John N. Ninkasong, said that the African CDC welcomes the waiver and called the decision leadership in action. He added, "History will remember this decision as a great act of humanity." Tai's announcement came hours after WTO Director General Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala spoke to a closed-door meeting of ambassadors from developing and developed countries that have been wrangling over the issue but agree on the need for wider access to COVID-19 treatments. The WTO's General Counsel took up the issue of a temporary waiver for intellectual property protections on COVID-19 vaccinations and other tools, which South Africa and India first proposed in October. The idea has gained support among some progressive lawmakers in the West. More than 100 countries have come out in support of the proposal, and a group of 110 members of Congress, all fellow Democrats of Biden, sent him a letter last month that called on him to support the waiver. Opponents, especially from industry, insist that production of the coronavirus vaccines are complex and can't be ramped up by easing intellectual property. They also say lifting protections could hurt future innovation. Stephen Ubel, president and CEO of the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, said the U.S. decision will sow confusion between public and private partners, further weaken already strained supply chains, and foster the proliferation of counterfeit vaccines, aka vaccines that he doesn't make money on. Just saying. Dr. Michelle McMurray-Heath, chief executive of the Biotechnology Innovation Organization Trade Group, said in a statement that the decision will undermine incentives to develop vaccines and treatment for further pandemics. See, this is the stuff I don't like. Like, they're saying, like, hey, if we are not the only ones that have the rights to this technology, and if we don't hold on to this intellectual property where we are the only ones making the money, maybe next time we won't want to come up with a vaccine. We won't be so motivated. Well, if money is the only thing that can motivate you in a pandemic that is taking 577,000 lives in our country alone, you lack basic compassion. And money has too big of a role in your life. You need to look in the mirror. I'm just saying. Handing needy countries a recipe book without the ingredients, safeguards, and sizable workforce needed will not help people waiting for the vaccine, she said. Pfizer declined to comment on Biden's announcement, I bet they did, as did Johnson & Johnson, because theirs is getting pulled from other countries all the time right now, which developed a one-dose vaccine meant to ease vaccination campaigns in poor and rural areas. Moderna and AstraZeneca didn't immediately respond to requests for comment. The companies have made some efforts to provide vaccine doses to poor countries at prices well below what they're charging wealthy nations. The argument, part of a long-running debate about intellectual property protection, centers on lifting patents, copyrights, and protections for industrial design and confidential information to help expand the production and deployment of vaccines during supply shortages. The aim is to suspend the rules for several years, just long enough to beat down the pandemic. The issue has become more pressing with the surge in cases in India, which we just reported on, the world's second most populous country and a key producer of vaccines. So when President Biden was running, during the time that he was running against Trump, he had already won the Democratic nomination. He was campaigning against Donald Trump. He would do media junkets and interviews. And this question came up. You know, they were talking a lot. One of the very main issues was what can be done in fighting this global pandemic? Like, how can we better things in our country? How can we better assist the rest of the world? What can be done to defeat this virus? And one thing that was popular even then was this idea of waiving intellectual property rights on the vaccines themselves so that they can be shared. The recipe, basically, the ingredients, the processes, the technology needed in order to make them can be shared openly without fear of knockoffs, because it's not about the money. It's about saving lives. And we're just going to spread this information far and wide for a certain period of time, so that we can all overcome this pandemic together. And at the time, Joe Biden, when asked if he was in favor of this, said absolutely he was in favor of it. Absolutely. It's something that has to be done if we want to help third world countries, if we want to help the poor, if we want to be the world leader, if we want to help get the world back on its feet. And in this pandemic, it has to be done. But then when he got elected, the pharmaceutical, Big Pharma, all the lobbyists that represent them came after him and his campaign, came after his cabinet hard and started pushing him the other way. They started pushing him more towards the center, more towards the right, saying like, hey, this is going to affect our business. hey, we give you a lot of money. Hey, this is going to mean that other countries are on better footing financially coming out of this thing than we are. Hey, we got to think about a lot of different things. This is going to affect a lot of different people. And Joe Biden started this way. One thing that I doubted, I heard it a lot from the Republicans, from those on the right. One thing I doubted with Joe Biden coming into office is that he was going to be able to be pushed left by the progressives. Because that was the thought process, was Joe Biden is not Bernie Sanders, but he is better than Donald Trump. This is what the progressives say. He is better than Donald Trump. And if we get him in office, maybe on some issues we can push him left. We can influence him. We can say, hey, we helped you get into office. Now meet us halfway. And I did not think that that was possible because if you look at his record, there's very little that is progressive, that has been progressive about Joe Biden in his 50 plus years in office. But at least in some degree, I've been wrong. Because there's been a couple of things now where Joe Biden has been pushed left. And this is one of those things. Now, this shouldn't even be, to me, this shouldn't even be a right and left issue because this is about health. This is about people dying. This is about taking care of the poor. For me, it's an issue of right or wrong. But politically, this is an issue of left or right. At least that's what it's being made out to be. And the progressives, for once, were able to overcome the lobbyists. Now, I tell you, on In the Shed with West, we keep it a buck. We keep it 100 with you. We're going to highlight the good things that Joe Biden does as president. We're going to highlight the negative things that he does, just like we did with Donald Trump, just like we always will do with any politician, no matter what side they fit on. And this, in my estimation, is something that Joe Biden has done that is good. And that's that he has kept his word when he was running for this office. He's doing what he said he would do, and he's making a decision with people over money, with people's health coming before profits. And you can say that he's doing that to gain favor. He's doing that for this reason and that reason politically. But if the end result is less people die, hey, I'm for that one. I'm for that one. And you might not like Joe Biden. You don't have to like Joe Biden. That's fine. That's fine. But in my estimation, and this is my shed after all, in my estimation, this is the right thing to do. Take the intellectual property, share it among other nations, share it among other producers that can make this medication, get it out there far and wide to as many parts of the earth, as many people as we can. Let's get people vaccinated. Let's get this thing over with. Let's turn the corner, not just as a nation, not just as a state, but as a global community, and let's move on together. So kudos to Joe Biden for doing what he said he would do. For not ultimately being swayed by the lobbyists, and good job for the progressives for pushing for something good, for sticking with it, for causing Joe Biden to move left on an issue that really isn't even about left or right. It's about humanity. Our last story in the world of politics, military blocks promotion of South Dakota Attorney General. The U.S. Army Reserve has blocked the promotion of South Dakota's Attorney General because of his role in the death of a man who was struck while walking along a rural highway last year. Jason Ravensborg last month announced on social media that he was being promoted to the rank of full colonel. However, the Army Reserve told the Angus Leader on Monday that the promotion has been flagged and won't be submitted to the U.S. Senate for confirmation until charges against Ravensborg are resolved. Their paper is called the Argus Leader? Yo. A message left at Ravensborg's office was not immediately returned on Tuesday. Ravensborg is facing 3 misdemeanor charges and calls for his resignation after he struck and killed Joe Beaver, who was walking on the side of Highway 14 near Highmore in September. Charges include distracted driving and driving on the shoulder of the road. In this case, relevant Army Reserve leaders will monitor the ongoing civilian proceedings and make further decisions at the appropriate time, said Army Reserve spokesperson Lieutenant Colonel Simon Blake. Beaver's body was found in a ditch the day after he was struck and killed. Ravensborg told authorities during a 911 call that he believed he had struck a deer. He's pleaded not guilty and is due in court May 12th. So this is a follow-up story. If you've listened to our show before, this is about our third or fourth time covering it, and we're going to keep covering it, especially when the court dates start happening on the 12th of this month. Yeah. Good for the Army, man. Good for the Army for not promoting this dude. This guy shouldn't even be in office. Like, how in the world I feel like we're beating a dead horse to cover this all the time, but how in the world do you remain in office after you hit a man with your car and kill him while on your cell phone? Because that is what happened unquestionably. I don't think this man should be charged with misdemeanors. I think it should be a felony. And there's stuff about this case that just doesn't sit right with me. It just doesn't sit right with me. This guy, Ravensburg, is at a political event. He's driving home late at night. He's on some backwoods country roads, probably the ones that he's driven forever. He's on his cell phone. Police have already proven that he's on his cell phone. He goes into the shoulder and hits a pedestrian and kills him. And he does call 911 a few minutes later. He says he thinks he hit a deer. I'm not even necessarily calling him a liar, because like maybe that could happen. Like, you're not sure, you were distracted, you weren't paying attention, you hit something, but you don't see anyone out there, it's dark, whatever, whatever. But yo, the suspicious thing is, the next day when he returned to the scene with the local sheriff, it said in that article I just read that Joe Beaver's body was discovered the next day. It was discovered by Jason Ravensburg. Yeah, the guy that was distracted, that was on his phone, that hit a person and killed him, and then called 911 and said, "I think I hit a deer," came back to the scene the next day with the local sheriff and just so happened to be the one to find the body. If that doesn't scream foul play or cover up, I don't know what is. Could it be coincidental? Absolutely, it could be. What I'm saying is nothing more than circumstantial evidence, and I recognize that. But even so, if you're distracted, if you go onto the shoulder and you take someone's life because of your distracted driving, you've broken the law. You don't get to be in public office, and you should be in jail. And Jason Ravensburg should be in jail, and I hope that he gets convicted. And I hope that Joe Beaver's family gets a little bit of justice, even if it's incomplete. That's all for the world of politics. Let's switch to sports, and let's hit the headlines. Zion out indefinitely. Pels blame league for injury. Eagles claim former Lions running back Kerryon Johnson off waivers. NFL allows resumption of off-site training camps. Packers to explore adding quarterbacks for training camp. Football from Brady's first touchdown pass going to auction. Warriors guard Damian Lee says he got COVID-19 despite being fully vaccinated. Nick Saban encourages vaccinations in new PSA. Presbyterian hires high school football coach who never punts. NCAA panel proposes technical fouls for flopping players. Kentucky adds two Illinois coaches to remake staff. And finally, Auburn signs Arkansas transfer guard Desi Seals. Our first story in the world of sports: Conor McGregor's Irish whiskey brand sells for up to $600 million. Conor McGregor is cashing in on the booze business. The UFC fighter and his partners have sold their majority stake in Proper No. 12 Irish whiskey for a deal worth up $600 million. Proximo Spirits, which previously held a 49% stake in the brand, is the buyer. Proximo owns Jose Cuervo and Bushmills, among other liquor brands in its portfolio. Both sides confirmed the transaction to industry publication Shankin News Daily on Tuesday. McGregor and his partners, Audie Adder and Ken Austin, will retain a stake. How much Proximo now owns beyond its controlling interest was not revealed, nor were the parameters defining how the deal would reach the $600 million total. When we started the business with Proximo, we basically laid out, I'll call it, certain hurdles that would allow them to buy pieces of the company over time, Austin told Proximo. We hit a milestone, and it gave Proximo the opportunity to own a significant stake. The $600 million figure includes $250 million Proximo previously paid in the partnership, according to Austin. It also sounds like McGregor will continue as the face of the brand. McGregor is frequently seen on his social media and television ads promoting Proper No. 12. Austin teased a promotion of the whiskey around McGregor's upcoming fight against Dustin Poirier at UFC 264 on July 10th. Is that fight still happening or what? I don't know. Conor is very, very fixated on this being a multi-million case brand, Austin told Shankin. I wouldn't count him out ever. McGregor also sounds as dedicated as ever to selling the brand. Proper 12 is my baby for life, McGregor said per his website, The Mac Life, in a story confirming the news. That story includes a picture of a beaming McGregor carrying a case of the whiskey in each arm while exiting a private plane. $600 million. Conor McGregor. I'm Conor McGregor. Is that any better than it was on episode 102 whenever I tried that last time? That man sold his liquor, his ownership stake in this liquor business for $600 million. Yeah, I think the picture shows him getting off a private plane with two cases of whiskey and a big smile. I bet it does. I bet it, $600 million, how you smiling now? $600 million. And I read a comment that was like, yeah, but he's only going to get like 150 to 200 million of that himself. Yeah, he's going to get 150 to 200 million of that himself. That is a lot of dough, my brother. That is a lot of dough. Conor McGregor's story is one that is amazing to see where he came from, come from nothing, and not only turn himself into one of the best fighters that UFC's ever seen, but also now to a legitimate businessman. And I don't know if he's still doing that fight in July with Dustin Poirier. I don't know if he still has it in him to fight someone like that, this ruthless, this talented, that's such a tactician in the octagon. I kind of think that maybe his best fighting days are behind him. He doesn't seem as hungry, but he's still a box office sell. And that man has turned into quite the businessman. But hey, $600 million. Good for Conor McGregor. Conor McGregor! Our next story in the world of sports, our In the Shed with Wes NFL Draft Class Rankings. Yeah. Yeah, what we did is we took a look at the selections of all teams in this year's NFL Draft, and instead of just issuing a letter grade, we're going to issue some rankings. The top five draft classes as ranked by me, Wes Anderson. And these are different than a lot of the other ones that I've seen. That's the thing about draft class rankings, is that they're completely subjective. None of these guys have ever played a down in the NFL, and truly, we don't really know who did the best or who had the best draft. It's just a guess. But I would like to share mine with you. After I compiled this list and put it together, I compared it up against the draft class rankings from Sporting News and from CBS Sports, and I thought it was pretty funny that only in one of those cases did any of my teams even crack the top 10. So they definitely disagree with me. You might disagree with me too. If so, you can email me at intheshedwithwes@gmail.com and let me know where I have messed up and where I've erred. But without further ado, here are my top five team rankings for how they did in this year's NFL draft. Number five, the Carolina Panthers. The Carolina Panthers had 11 picks this year in the draft. They picked 6 offensive players and 4 defensive players, as well as a special teams player. 6 picks came from the SEC, 1 from the Pac-12, 1 from the Big Ten, 1 from the Big 12, and 1 from both Notre Dame and BYU. In the first round, they picked J.C. Horn, a cornerback from South Carolina. I think that he'll be a lockdown corner in Carolina for several years. I like that pick a lot there. In the second round, they took Terrace Marshall Jr., a wide receiver from LSU. A lot of talent, and they really need some help at wide receiver in Carolina. They have for years. In the third round, they picked Brady Christensen, a tackle from BYU. I think that's a good pick. In the third round, they also took Tommy Trimble, a tight end from Notre Dame. In the fourth round, they took Chuba Hubbard, running back from Oklahoma State. And Chuba Hubbard, that's an underrated pick there in the fourth round. He's been one of the best running backs in college football for the last several years. And I know that they're pretty well set in Carolina at running back. However, it's also true that Christian McCaffrey is injury prone. He can't stay healthy. And even if he is in the NFL, you need to do running back by committee anyway. I think Chuba Hubbard in the fourth round is a lot of value and a good pick there. In the fifth round, they had 2 selections. They picked Davion Nixon, a defensive tackle from Iowa, and Keith Taylor, a cornerback from Washington. In the sixth round, I think that they found a lot of value in Deontay Brown, a guard from Alabama, and in Shai Smith, a wide receiver from South Carolina. I think those are both solid pickups for the Panthers there. Also in the sixth round, they got Thomas Fletcher, a long snapper out of Alabama. That's kind of funny that they picked a long snapper in the NFL draft. But hey, you do you, Carolina Panthers. You still made my top five rankings. And then in the seventh round, they got Phil Hoskins, a defensive tackle from Kentucky. And as far as defensive players in the seventh round go, I think Phil Hoskins was a good pick. He's got a chance to not only make the roster, but to stick there in Carolina and to be somebody that gets some plays on third down, somebody that can kind of be a run stopper there in the middle there for Carolina Panther defense. So they did a lot to address their offense. They picked some defensive players that can fit in their system, that can play. I have the Carolina Panthers as the fifth-ranked draft class in this year's draft. My fourth-ranked draft class in this year's draft were the Indianapolis Colts. The Colts only had 7 picks in this year's draft, and they chose to go with 4 offensive players and 3 defensive players. They had 2 players picked from the SEC, 2 from the Big Ten, and 1 from the Big 12. In the first round, they used their selection to pick Kwity Paye, a defensive end from Michigan. And I really like this player. I like this pick for the Colts. I think that Kwity Paye is a player that in the NFL has a lot of flexibility. I think that he'll be able to rush the passer. He'll be able to shoot the gaps, but also drop back and cover tight ends and coverage. I think that he's a guy that can be moved around a lot, and I like that pick in the first round for the Colts. In the second round, they picked Dayo Odenyingbo, a defensive end from Vanderbilt. So the Colts go with 2 defensive ends, 1 in the first round and 1 in the second. And I actually like that they did that. I think that their ability to rush the passer is something that they need to improve upon, and they addressed it in both the first and the second round. In the fourth round, the Colts picked Kylan Granson, a tight end from SMU. In the fifth round, they picked Sean Davis, a safety from Florida. And in the sixth round, they got Sam Ellinger, quarterback from Texas. I found this to be a super interesting pick. The Colts, who have just traded for Carson Wentz in the offseason, who have Jacob Eason on the roster. But Sam Ellinger is an interesting player. He improved a lot while at Texas. He's undersized, but he's mobile. He has a big arm. And I like that pick in the sixth round. They already addressed their ability to rush the passer. They shored up their depth at safety and tight end. And then to pick a player like Sam Ellinger in the sixth round, I think that that's a risk worth taking. And then in the seventh round, the Colts had 3 picks. They got Mike Strachan, a wide receiver from Charleston. Will Fries, a tackle from Penn State. I think that's a good pickup in the seventh round there. And I think that the Colts addressed some needs. I think that they made the most of the picks that they have. The guys that they picked have high ceilings. Some of those picks may not work out, but the ones that do are going to be great. And I have them ranked at number 4 overall. My third ranked draft class this year were the Jacksonville Jaguars. Now, I know a lot of people did not like what Urban Meyer and crew in Jacksonville did in this year's draft as a whole. I disagree. With the number 1 overall pick in the first round, they took Trevor Lawrence, QB from Clemson. And then also with the 25th overall pick in the first round, they took Travis Etienne, running back from Clemson. Now, a lot of people thought that this was a bad move because Jacksonville already has some promising young talent at running back. Because you're not supposed to take a running back in the first round unless they're one of the best 2 or 3 players in the draft, blah, 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 blah. Jacksonville's all about picking up winners. They need culture guys. They need talent. They need depth at every position. So for them to pick up 2 guys from a national championship perennial contender like Clemson, 2 guys that are high-character players, 2 guys that have talent, 2 guys that get along, 2 guys that help lift their offense immediately, I think that's a good selection. In the second round, the Jaguars took Tyson Campbell, a cornerback from Georgia. He's a good player. They also took Walker Little, a tackle from Stanford. Add some depth there at tackle. In the third round, they picked Andre Sisco, a safety from Syracuse. In the fourth round, they took Jay Tufalele, a defensive tackle from USC. In the fourth round, they also took Jordan Smith, a defensive end from UAB. And being from Alabama, I'm familiar with him and think that he has a chance to be a good player there in Jacksonville. Will surprise a lot of people. In the fifth round, they took Luke Farrell, a tight end that Urban Meyer is familiar with from Ohio State. And in the sixth round, they took Jalen Camp, a wide receiver from Georgia Tech. So I happen to really like what the Jacksonville Jaguars did. They had 9 picks. A majority of them went to the offensive side of the football just like they should. 5 offensive selections and 4 defensive. They only got one player from the SEC, but they got four from the ACC, one from the Big Ten, and two from the Pac-12. And I think everything that they did will add depth to their team immediately. I don't know how many games Jacksonville will win this year. I don't know how well Trevor Lawrence will play as a rookie. I don't know how Urban Meyer will translate long-term to the NFL. But I like what they did in their first draft, and I have them ranked number three overall in my draft classes for this year's NFL draft. My number two ranked draft class in this year's draft, the San Francisco 49ers. The 49ers had 8 picks in the draft. They went 5 offensive and 3 defensive, with 2 selections from the Big Ten, 2 from the Pac-12, and 1 from Notre Dame. With their first round pick, they took Trey Lance, quarterback from North Dakota State. I'm not sure what to make of Trey Lance. I haven't watched him play in college. All I've seen is highlights. I don't know if he's going to be great or if he's going to be a bust, but it seems like he's going to be boom or bust. Hopefully he gets a solid year to sit and to learn. He definitely has a lot of talent, but that's who they took with their first pick. In the second round, they took Aaron Banks, a guard from Notre Dame. The third round, they took Trey Sermon, a running back from Ohio State. And Trey Sermon might be my favorite running back in this year's draft. I love the way Trey Sermon runs the football. He runs the football with such determination. He runs the football with such tenacity. And I think in the third round that that's a value pick, that there's a lot of good things to like about that. Also in the third round, they took Ambry Thomas, a cornerback from Michigan, who I really like. In the fifth round, the 49ers took Jalen Moore, a guard from Western Michigan, and Diamador Lenore, a cornerback from Oregon, who might have the best name in the draft. Diamador Lenore. Number two, Diamador Lenore. Like, that's a dope name, though. Also in the fifth round, they had lots of picks in the fifth round. The 49ers took Talanoa Hufanga, a safety from USC. And in the sixth round, they took Elijah Mitchell, another running back from Louisville. I just like what the 49ers did. They added a lot of depth. This was a draft for them to add talent, to add depth, and I feel like they accomplished that. They got a lot of players for their offense. They got some players for their offensive line, their defensive backfield. And in looking at all of the teams in their draft classes, I have them as the second best overall. I think they did a superb job. I think that they addressed their issues, and I'm really excited about the 49ers' future with this draft. And in my estimation, the team that had the best draft this year as a whole, are you ready for this? The New York Jets. Yeah. Yeah. I'm in my shed at midnight, and I'm telling you that the New York Jets had the best draft of any team in the NFL this year. And I know that that's hard to believe. And I know that you're thinking, there is no way that that can be correct, that a team like the New York Jets, that have been a dumpster fire for years, could possibly have the best draft class. But hey, I think they did. I think they did. The Jets had 10 picks in this year's draft. They were strategic on offense. They picked 4 offensive players, 6 defensive players. They got 4 players from the SEC, 4 from the ACC, 1 from the Pac-12, 1 from BYU. Their first round pick, they took Zach Wilson, number 2 overall, the quarterback from BYU. And I don't know. I'm not that big on Zach Wilson. I watched him play. He's got a lot of talent. I've seen him play 6 to 8 games last season and a half. He's a good player. I don't know if he's going to be much more than above average in the NFL. And he is in the organization. Even though I'm saying that they have had the best draft class this year, even though I believe in their head coach that they hired, he got drafted to a team that has stunk. And I mean, like, has really, really stunk. I don't know. I think Zach Wilson is a little bit of a stretch. I just wasn't seeing what everybody else saw. I thought Justin Fields was a much better NFL prospect. I didn't think it was close. And I was kind of surprised that Zach Wilson shot up the way he did up the draft boards. Maybe it'll be a good pick, but that's who they picked. They like him a lot. They took him with their number 2 overall pick, their pick in the first round. Their other pick in the first round, the Jets took Elijah Vera Tucker, a guard from USC, who I happen to think is a great pick. I'm very, very high on that pick. I think that that was a tremendous one, as well as the next 2 or 3 picks as well. In the second round, the Jets took Elijah Moore, wide receiver from Ole Miss. He's electric. I think he's going to be a great NFL player. I think that he can move around a lot. He can play in the slot. He's got speed to go over the top. He can catch it and run out of the backfield. He can take a screen up the field. He can go across the middle. Elijah Moore is going to be a good NFL player for a long time. Love that pick in the second round. In the fourth round, the Jets took Michael Carter, running back from North Carolina. I think that he'll add good depth for the Jets. I think that he'll get playing time for sure. And in the fifth round, they addressed their defensive backfield. So in the fifth round, the Jets took Jamien Sherwood, a safety from Auburn. They also took Michael Carter II, a safety from Duke. And they took Jason Pinnick, a cornerback from Pittsburgh. So just in the fifth round alone, they took two safeties that have great potential, and they took a cornerback. So even if they miss on two out of those three, they've already got one player they can plug in that can play from day one. The sixth round, they had three more picks. They took Hamza Nasiruddin. That's a cool name. Hamza Nasiruddin. He's a safety from Florida State. I'm not familiar with him. I am familiar with Brandon Echols, a cornerback from Kentucky. I think that's a tremendous pick. I think that he's an NFL cornerback for sure. He has good size, good ball skills. And then they also took Jonathan Marshall, a defensive tackle from Arkansas. He was their last pick in the draft. He was picked in the sixth round, and I think that that's a good value pick there. I just like what the Jets did. I'm not sure about the quarterback they picked, but their next three or four or five picks down after that were all very solid picks. They addressed the defensive backfield. They went after the type of guys that they like, the toughness, the character. They were strategic in their selection of offensive players. They were broad in their net of defensive players that they took. And I think that a draft like this is really going to do a lot for them. They got quantity. They got quality. They checked both boxes. And that's why I have the Jets as the number one draft class overall. I like their head coach. I like what they did in this year's draft. Shows a lot of promise, and we'll see if they have put out the dumpster fire in New York, if they can actually have two NFL teams in New York rather than one team and this other squad. So we'll see. But this year I have the Jets as having the number one draft class. What do you think? Who do you think had the top five draft classes in NFL? Get at us, email the show at intheshedwithwes@gmail.com and let us know. Do you agree with me that the Jets had the best draft overall? Do you disagree with me? Do you think I'm crazy for even having the Jaguars in the top five? Email the show and let us know. Our last story in the world of sports, NFL player hosts party at homeless shelter where he used to live. Hours before he was drafted by the Pittsburgh Steelers, running back Najee Harris stopped by the homeless shelter where he used to live in Richmond, California. There, the 23-year-old hosted a draft party and provided food for everyone in attendance. I wanted to make sure that I could give back to the community and show them if y'all still need anything. I'm never too big or too whatever to help you guys out. I'm always going to be the helping hand, Harris told reporters. In 2010, Harris lived with his mother and four siblings in a tiny room at the Greater Richmond Interfaith Program shelter. Kathleen Sullivan, the organization's executive director, told CBS San Francisco, his mother was instrumental in getting him and all those children through what would normally be the most horrific experience of their lives. Harris described the feelings his mother felt visiting the shelter. It was really emotional for my mom, almost as if she was crying because we have a lot of memories here. That was a time in my life when it was really low. It brought back a lot of memories of what we were going through at the time, he told reporters. The Steelers selected Harris out of the University of Alabama in the first round with a 24th overall pick, and he's expected to make an immediate impact on the team. Harris helped Alabama win two national titles in 2017 and 2020 and took home last year's Doak Walker Award, which honors college football's best running back. He leaves as the university's all-time leader in total touchdowns with 57. Harris is working on forming a nonprofit organization in Richmond and hopes to continue giving back to the shelter in the years to come. There was a time I needed a helping hand. They gave us an opportunity to get back on our feet. So it's my job to give back, Harris told reporters. Yo, I wanted to share that one because I talked about the best draft classes that teams had this year. This is the best story. This is the best character story that came out of this year's draft. And I'm an Auburn fan. I make no bones about it. I do not like Alabama as a team. But I'm going to root for Najee Harris. I always have respected him as a runner. The man is unstoppable in the game of college football. I think that that would translate to the NFL, and he'll be a very good ball carrier for the Steelers. He'll fit in from day one. He'll challenge them, work hard, and make them a better football team. But yo, apparently Najee Harris is an even better dude than he is a football player. He says at the end of this article here, they gave us an opportunity when I needed a helping hand to get back onto our feet, so it's my job to do the same. That's beautiful. Kudos to Najee Harris. I'm going to be rooting for you. Not a Pittsburgh Steelers fan, but I hope you break some records. I hope you have a long NFL career. And to know that the money you make and the things that you've been given, you'll use those to bless other people is a wonderful thing. And I wanted to share that story with you, my tools. That's all for the world of sports. Let's go to the world of the paranormal. And let's go to the land of Florida. Florida residents in uproar as scientists prepare to release 750 million genetically modified mosquitoes. Florida residents are furious as scientists prepare to release hundreds of millions of genetically modified mosquitoes into their communities. I understand why. I would be upset too. The experiment, led by British biotech company Oxitec, will see around 750 million male mosquitoes sent out into the Florida Keys over the next 2 years in an attempt to control the population of an invasive disease-carrying species which has settled in the area. But many residents are unhappy at being part of what one group called a Jurassic Park experiment. I think it would be fun to be a part of Jurassic Park. That movie was dope. The first wave of the project will see thousands of mosquitoes released at 6 locations this week, with 144,000 expected to be set free in the first 12 weeks overall. The project has been launched to combat the Aedes aegypti mosquito, which makes up about 4% of the mosquito population in the Keys, but is responsible for virtually all mosquito-borne diseases transmitted to humans, including dengue, Zika, and yellow fever. It can also transmit heartworm and other potentially deadly illness to pets and animals. Only female mosquitoes bite humans and pass on disease because they need blood to produce eggs. Oxitec has modified the genes of male mosquitoes so that they carry a protein that will kill any female offspring before they reach mature biting age. Males, which only feed on nectar, will survive and pass on the genes. The hope is that the modified male mosquitoes will breed with the existing wild female mosquitoes, slowly eliminating the Aedes aegypti mosquito. While the project has approval, easy for me to say, from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, Barry Ray of the Florida Keys Environmental Coalition said, "People here in Florida do not consent to the genetically engineered mosquitoes or to being human experiments, because you gotta draw the line somewhere, and it ain't snatching golf balls from alligators. It's genetically modified mosquitoes. You can find us doing all sorts of crazy things in Florida, but hey, we draw the line at genetically modified mosquitoes. That we will not do." Megan Hole, a resident of Islamadora, told a council meeting, "I find this criminal that we are being bullied into this experiment," Futurism reported. Earlier this year, dozens of protesters gathered outside the Murray Nelson Government and Cultural Arts Center in Key Largo. It says dozens of protesters? So multiples of 12. So like 36 people. 36 people gathered outside the Murray Nelson Government and Cultural Arts Center in Key Largo, complaining that the full impact of the experiment could not be known. Yes, that is what an experiment is, Florida. That is what... I'm glad you know what an experiment is. In a statement denouncing the project, environmental group Friends of the Earth said, "The release of genetically engineered mosquitoes will needlessly put Floridians, the environment, and endangered species at risk in the midst of a pandemic." But Oxitec said, "We have released over a billion of our mosquitoes over the years." I'm sorry, what? You have done what? You have released over a billion? With a B? Billions, billions, billions and 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 billions. Of mosquitoes? There is no potential risk for the environment or humans. Oxitec said its modified mosquitoes have successfully provided significant suppression of the wild Aedes aegypti in other geographies and do not cause harm to beneficial insects like bees and butterflies. Similar projects in the Brazilian city of Indaiatuba found that Oxytec's mosquito suppressed the Aedes aegypti by up to 95% in urban areas following just 13 weeks of treatment as compared to untreated control sites in the same city. Huh. Normally, I am not in the mood to be experimented on. If something is genetically modified, chances are I want no part of it. I don't want genetically modified food. I don't want to be around genetically modified animals. But in this case, I might be open to it. Because if it's genetically modified mosquitoes, and I just learned in this article for the first time ever that every time I have ever been bit by a mosquito in my life, it has been a female. I did not know that only the females did the biting. But if it is only the females that do the biting, and all of the genetically modified ones are males, and their only role is to take out these females that be biting me, I can get on board with that. Go ahead and release the billion. Go ahead and release them. Even though those dozens of Floridians have drawn a line in the sand. Let's let the high tide wash that line away. Bring on the genetically modified mosquitoes. Bring them on. From the great state of Florida, we go to the even greater state of New Jersey. That's right. I see you crazy, and I raise you some more crazy. Mystery UFO detector found in New Jersey Park and dismantled by police. A mysterious makeshift UFO detector found in a New Jersey park has been dismantled by puzzled police. The device, referred to as a UFO detector site, was discovered. What the heck was that? Oh, that's a dog. Can y'all hear that? Man, that sounded crazy. That scared the crap out of me. Oh, man, I'm out here at midnight. All these dogs supposed to be asleep. I don't know what that was, y'all. That scared me to death. But I digress. The device, referred to as a UFO detector site, was discovered in Wharton State Forest and consisted of a headphone wire connecting a block of wood and a soup can. A headphone wire connecting a block of wood and a soup can. Okay. The New Jersey State Police Detective Unit, as well as the canine unit, were deployed to the scene in the township of Tabernacle. After careful examination, the contraption was deemed to be safe. Police said they disarmed the device by unplugging the headphone wire from the block of wood and the soup can it was plugged into. Oh, they disarmed it. I don't think that you get credit for disarming the device if you're unplugging a headphone wire from a block of wood and a soup can. I don't think so. Police also shared a photo of the device revealing the identification tag UFO detector site number 448 attached to an orange rod. It remains unclear who set up the gadget or whether another 447 similar devices exist. Although humankind and the visitors to New Jersey State Parks appreciate an extraterrestrial early warning device like this, we should not be finding them in our state parks, the park police wrote. Please always be safe when around suspicious objects like this, and always notify the New Jersey State Park Police if a suspicious object is found in our parks. According to the National UFO Reporting Center, there was a UFO sighting in Wharton State Forest on October 20th of 2020. I have video of four circular lights moving back and forth and up and down stationary. Fifth object was much larger and wider, also moving side to side and slowly moving out of sight, an anonymous user posted. 15 alleged UFO sightings have been reported throughout the state to the center so far this year. UFOs and UFO sightings are a favorite topic in American popular culture and around the world. Every year, people come forward with claims and encounters with the sky's unexplained phenomena. Do 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 phenomena. Do 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 phenomena. Do 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 da 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 da. Since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, UFO sightings in the U.S. and Canada are said to have increased by over 50%, according to one researcher who studies unidentified flying objects by tracking reports cited by UFO organizations, government sources, and social media networks. Federal agencies have been asked to publish a report on UFOs this year, thanks to an act included in the $2.3 trillion stimulus and government spending bill signed by President Donald Trump last year. In March, former Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe said that the upcoming government report will show more sightings that are difficult to explain, adding that he had hoped to declassify such findings during his tenure in the Trump administration. Yeah, so I encourage you to go online and look up this UFO detector. It is exactly what is in your head right now. The image that you are picturing of a wooden block and a soup can attached by a wire on an orange pole, it is exactly what you think it is. And I do not think this is just a guess, just me. I don't think that it is very helpful or useful. From the state of New Jersey, we go to the recent past to follow up on a previous report that we've done before. Did novelist predict Titanic disaster 14 years beforehand? On April 10th in 1912, the RMS Titanic departed Southampton, England for her maiden voyage to New York. As virtually everyone knows, she never reached her destination. The great ship that was deemed unsinkable by the media struck an iceberg just a few days later and plunged to the bottom of the Atlantic in less than 3 hours, with approximately two-thirds of her estimated 2,224 passengers and crew still aboard. While the details of the disaster have long since passed into common knowledge, it's surprising to many to learn that a novel published 14 years before the Titanic sinking foreshadowed the actual events with what would seem to be uncanny accuracy. American-born Morgan Andrew Robertson first went to sea as a cabin boy at the age of 5. After a career at sea that lasted over 30 years, he turned his attention elsewhere, first to jewelry making and then to writing. Drawing upon his maritime experiences, he penned adventure stories set at sea, which were published by popular magazines of the day, including McClure's and the Saturday Evening Post. In 1898, he published a short novel titled Futility. It told about an enormous British passenger liner that sank in April in the North Atlantic while loaded with rich and famous socialites, many of whom perished due to a scarcity of lifeboats. Oh, and the fictional ship's name? Titan. Other similarities between Robertson's fictional account and the actual events include that both the Titan and the Titanic had 4 smokestacks, that both ships were driven by triple screws, that's propellers, that both ships were considered unsinkable, that both were the largest ships of their day, and that the Titan's top speed was 24 to 25 knots, while the Titanic's was 21 to 23 knots. Was it clairvoyance? Evidence of time travel? Or maybe just wild coincidence? Robertson, who died in 1915, just 3 years after the Titanic sinking, steadfastly denied any paranormal explanation at all, crediting instead his first-hand knowledge of the shipping business and ability to project trends. If that man was that good at projecting trends, he should have been playing the lottery. I don't know if they had the lottery in 1915, but if they did, this man should have been a player. Because how crazy is it that 14 years before the Titanic ever took sail, this man wrote a book about a ship called the Titan that was labeled unsinkable, that went the same speed, that was also the largest ship, that left Britain carrying celebrities and socialites, and that sank in the Atlantic Ocean. Like, the fact that he wrote that and then it happened 14 years later, that is one of the most bizarre things about that whole conspiracy theory. And it's one of those things that you look at and you just can't explain. Do I think that he knew what was going to happen? No, I don't think so. And I'm not even sure, even though there's a lot of weird stuff about that conspiracy that we have covered before on this show, that the Titanic was sunk on purpose, or at least that it was swapped out with a less seaworthy ship. There's a lot of weird stuff about that whole thing. I don't quite buy into it. But yo, this is weird. This is weird. This is one of those things that just makes you go, huh? Because this man wrote this stuff 14 years before it happened. And I got to tell you, some of his similarities in his story and what really happened are a lot more accurate than my boy Nostradamus. And people are still on that Nostradamus stuff. If you ever look at Nostradamus, his stuff that he wrote was just so vague. He'd be like, one day people will be evil and go to war. And we're like, hey, people are evil. And people did go to war. Nostradamus was right. But this guy was like, there's going to be a ship called the Titan that carries rich people
from England that's the largest and fastest ship, and it's going to sink, and people die because they don't have lifeboats. And then that really that really happened. That's a creepy story. What do you think about that? Do you think that that kind of adds to the Titanic conspiracy? Do you think that it's just a coincidence and a creepy one at that? Do you think this guy had some knowledge? What's going on with that story? Email the show at intheshedwithwes@gmail.com and let us know what you think. For our last story in the world of the paranormal, are mermaids real? That's right, Kristen from Florida. You are finally getting your mermaid episode. Here on episode 13 of In the Shed with Wes Anderson, we're going to give you what you want. Kristen has emailed the show twice asking for a mermaid episode, and we are here for you, our people, our tools. In mythology, mermaids or mermaid-like creatures have existed for thousands of years. The first myths of mermaids may have originated around 1000 BC. Stories tell of the tale of a Syrian goddess who jumped into a lake to turn into a fish, but her great beauty could not be changed and only her bottom half was transformed. Since then, many other mermaid stories have appeared in folklore from various cultures around the world. For instance, the African water spirit, Mami Wada, is mermaid in form, as is the water spirit, Lassarin, who is popular in folklore in the Caribbean islands. Throughout history, various explorers have reported sightings of mermaids, the most famous of which was Christopher Columbus. Columbus claimed to have spotted mermaids near Haiti in 1493, which he described as being not as pretty as they're depicted. For somehow in the face, they look like men, according to the American Museum of Natural History. That's a real quote. Captain John Smith is described in Edward Rowe Snow's Incredible Mysteries and Legends of the Sea as seeing a big-eyed, green-haired mermaid in 1614 off the coast of Newfoundland. Apparently, Smith felt love for her until he realized she was a fish from the waist down. Experts believe Columbus, Smith, and other mermaid-spotting explorers really caught glimpses of human-sized marine mammals called manatees and dugongs. Indeed, despite past and recent sightings of the mythical sea creatures, mermaids, like the Loch Ness Monster, may just be a case of mistaken identity. So what do you think when you hear the word mermaid? A mythical creature who is half woman and half fish but can grow legs and walk into New York City undetected? A beautiful woman who lured sailors with their singing and then dragged them to their death and ate them. One of the most recent accounts of a mermaid sighting was in the town of Kiryat Yam, Israel. Locals and tourists in the Israeli town of Kiryat Yam have been flocking to the coast in hopes of glimpsing a creature that most people believe only exists in fairy tales. An alleged mermaid said to resemble a cross between a fish and a young girl only appears at sunset. It performs a few tricks for onlookers before disappearing for the night. One of the first people to see the creature, Shlomo Cohen, said, "I was with friends when suddenly we saw a woman lying on the sand in a weird way. At first I thought she was just another sunbather, but when we approached, she jumped into the water and disappeared. We were all in shock because we saw that she had a tail." Probably the most famous of the mermaid sightings in Orkney took place over a few summers around 1890. At this time, there were a series of sightings of a creature that came to be known as the Dearness Mermaid. Regular visitor to Newark Bay in Dearness, from documented reports, is said that the mermaid stayed some distance from the shore. One of the eyewitnesses at the time said it is about 6 to 7 feet in length, has a little black head with neck, a snow-white body and two arms, and is swimming. It just appears like a human being. At times, it will appear to be sighting up on a sunken rock and will wave and work its hands. These are just a few of the legends and stories when it comes to mermaids. With so many stories and eyewitness accounts of mermaids, is it possible that they were or are real? As we said earlier, even the infamous explorer of his time, Christopher Columbus, swore that he had seen one of these creatures. However, many people believe that what he had actually seen was a manatee. Even in the United Kingdom, there have been sightings of mermaids, mainly in Cornwall. A fisherman claimed that a woman had swum up to his boat and asked him to move his anchor because it was blocking her way home. Of course, nowadays, some women actually make a living out of being a mermaid. For example, mermaid Melissa uses her deep-sea diving skills and tail to promote the importance of protecting sea creatures of all variety. With countless stories from around the world, is it possible that mermaids are real? What do you think, my tools? Are mermaids real? Is it possible that at one point in time, there was a humanoid type sea creature that existed and that has either gone extinct or is so rare that we don't see it very often? If there were a place for something to exist that we did not know, would the ocean not be the perfect place, as most of it lies unexamined and unexplored to this day? I remember a few years ago, there was that documentary that was out on Animal Planet. You remember this? I think it was called like Body Found, New Evidence or something. It was a mermaid documentary, quote-unquote documentary. And it had like a couple of sentences at the very end of the thing in small print that said that basically none of the scientists shown were real scientists. They were just actors portraying scientists, blah, 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 blah. But all these people watched this thing on TV, and they had some really good CGI and some really cheesy CGI, and they had some actual pictures and actual clips that people had taken that didn't make a lot of sense. And they had people on there, and Twitter blew up, and people were like, yo, Discovery Channel, Animal Planet just said mermaids are real. And one thing that they highlighted on there was this theory, this scientific theory that life comes from the sea. And it's like the aquatic ape theory that at one point in time, there were life forms that were more on the scale of human, or at least moving toward human in the process of evolution, that were in the sea, that eventually kind of came to the land and developed legs and arms and kind of were like we were. And that maybe there could be creatures in the sea that are in the middle of that process, or that that never went through that process. And the funny thing is, this documentary was no documentary at all. It was a crocumentary. But the aquatic ape theory is a real theory. Now, it routinely gets dismissed. It doesn't get a lot of play by most scientists, but it's an actual scientific theory. Like, you can look it up. You can see that some people believe that life started in the sea. It's not like flat Earth. No offense to Jerry. It's not like flat Earth. There's actually people out here, real scientists, that think that there's some level of validity or at least possibility to that story. So do I think that Christopher Columbus saw a manatee and thought it was a mermaid? Nah. You ever seen a manatee? I've seen a manatee. Like, they're pretty animals, but I have a hard time believing anybody would mistake a manatee for a person, even if they had never seen one before. Like, I have a hard time believing that. And there's some videos out on YouTube and on the internet right now of quote-unquote mermaids, or things that people find that wash up on shore that look odd, or they don't look like any fish. I mean, there's a lot out there. So Kristen from Florida, this is your mermaid episode, and I don't think that you're crazy. I think that if there's any place that something could exist, some type of animal that we have not discovered yet, could it be the ocean? Absolutely. I don't think that there are all of these mermaids like what we see in The Little Mermaid, and that they're just like people but then have tails and they swim around and talk to each other and have fish for pets and all this kind of stuff. I don't think that. But do I think that there was or is or could be some type of fish that is more humanoid than any other type of fish in its appearance, or that could be mistaken from a distance as being humanoid? I'm open to that. It's a fun idea. And what do you think? What do you think, my tools? Do you think that mermaids are real? Do you think it's a possibility? Get at us. Let us know what you think. We always love to hear from you. Email us at intheshedwithwes@gmail.com and let us know. And if nothing else, this is proof to you that if you email us and you ask for a certain topic to be discussed on the show, chances are, over time, it will be discussed. Kristen from Florida has asked for a mermaid episode twice, and she finally got it. Jerry might send in another email and ask for some more flat earth. And, you know, if he does, then we might just oblige. So what do you want to hear about? What stories do you want to be covered in our paranormal segment? Let us know. We would love to hear from you. That's all for this week. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. I can't either. It's back in the house and out of the shed for me. Thanks again for listening to episode 13. Make sure to subscribe, like, share, and review. It really does help. If you have any paranormal experiences, opinions about sports or politics that you'd like to share, you can email the show at intheshedwithwes@gmail.com. Again, that's intheshedwithwes@gmail.com. I might even read it on air. Look for us on Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, or wherever you listen to podcasts, and make sure to follow us on Twitter at InTheShed. Tune in again next week when we'll hit the headlines, preview the SEC East football season, and learn about the unbelievable story of the Mercury Girls. This has been In the Shed with Wes Anderson, the best news show in the land covering politics, sports, and the paranormal. Have an adventurous and fulfilling weekend. I'll catch you tools later. Peace out, Boy Scout. Meemaw, we made it!